California area. The play runs from September 20th to October 12th at the Graf Angeles Gallery in the Arts District. Jessie will be on, I believe, next week, and she will give more details. But, you know, save that date for sure. The other announcement I want to make is about Gary Baca. Listen in on Tuesdays for Global Village. He's an amazing producer. What he's doing here with me is amazing, and his show is wonderful. Plays excellent music. So thank you for listening. I am sorry I'm so out of it today. I'll be back in 2 weeks.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me.
KPFK invites you to tune into the Global Village weekdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. bringing you a global mix of hosts seeking the universal soul and making musical connections between our geographical and musical cultures. That's the Global Village, KPFK's flagship music program, with new and familiar voices, Monday through Friday, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right here on 90.7 FM and online at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's show, we talk to Professor Warren Montag, a longtime scholar and activist who has been targeted for speaking out against Israel's war on Gaza. In November, he gave a talk at his university arguing that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. What followed was an ADL campaign, the Anti-Defamation League, to get him fired as retaliation. Warren joins us with his personal testimony, his take on the campaign to silence critics of Israeli policy, what it means for freedom of expression, and so much more when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Very pleased to have Warren Montag back with us. He's a tenured full professor at Occidental College and was just targeted recently for a talk at a college forum on the issues raised in the U.S. by Israel's war on Gaza. His topic was one he had spoken on numerous times since the first Intifada, and that was that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. We're going to get his understanding of that, as well as the story of what happened subsequently. And we're also going to ask Warren what this campaign of intimidation and retaliation means for freedom of expression, freedom of inquiry, and so much more, especially in an atmosphere where book banning and stifling of critical thought, harassment of librarians, teachers, and professors is broad, rampant, and dangerous. So, Warren, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let me introduce you properly. I said that you were a tenured professor. You're a full professor of English and comparative literature at Occidental College here in Los Angeles, and the author of several books on the work of Althusser, Spinoza, Adam Smith, including the other Adam Smith, Althusser and his contemporaries, Body, Masses, Power, Spinoza and his contemporaries, and The Unthinkable Swift. And if you just Google Warren Montag without the UE at the end of Montag, you can find so much more. So we're going to spend a lot of time on this issue today because it's both international and domestic and ominous. And so if you could just begin by telling the listeners what happened on your campus. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I should just say, that you published a piece on this, of what happened at the Verso blog. And there you said that you've done this talk on anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism on many occasions over many years. So what was different this time in both the reaction and response to your views expressed at the forum and then afterwards?
Yeah, let me start by saying that I was somewhat reluctant even to write something about it or talk on even on the show, because I thought that what happened to me was not as spectacular or as destructive for me as what I think other people have experienced. And the reason that I wanted to talk about it finally was that in various ways that may be subtle or not so visible, you know, for me, I wasn't risking very much because I couldn't get fired, really. But there are many different ways of pressuring people and intimidating people and threatening them directly or indirectly. And the experience of seeing my colleagues at school even reacting to my experience, which they found more disturbing than I found it, really, I could see that it would be quite easy to intimidate people, make them feel uncomfortable, and not because the people aren't courageous, or it's quite the opposite. I mean, many of the people who were involved in this fair, in terms of faculty, were untenured, and it was extremely courageous of them to do this in the face of massive threats and opposition and you know, a lot of intimidation. So to go back to your question, what caught me off guard, because I, you know, usually I'm fairly in tune with the kinds of things that are going on around politics and that sort of thing, but it was nothing like what I'd experienced ever at the college or in politics and on campuses. The last time I gave the talk was 2018. And it was around the time of the March of the Great Return, which was connected with what I was talking about. And I spent a lot of time talking about anti-Zionist movements among Jews prior to World War II, and how socialist and communist groups, especially the Bund, in which Jews played a very important role. The Bund was an exclusively Jewish, Yiddish-speaking organization in Eastern Europe that advocated for nationalism, but not based on a territory, and also not exclusionary in any way. That one of the interesting things about the Bund is they actually, in Russia, before the revolution, they tried to initiate a kind of umbrella organization, and they sent emissaries to the Muslim Central Republics, were part of Russia at the time, and tried to make contacts with them, and it was fairly successful. So it's an interesting history. Okay.
I specifically want to ask you more about the history, but let's first just get for the listeners.
Yeah, sorry.
You know, no, it's okay. What happened?
Okay, yes. So I came to this particular meeting last November, about a month after October 7th. And there had been discussion before. I was part of a group that placed an article in the student newspaper condemning the war in Gaza and saying that it was an example of a settler colonial society trying to carry out ethnic cleansing. And it was looking like there was a kind of genocidal intent. And I can talk about that. And so we put that letter into the newspaper finally. And the response was surprisingly negative. I mean, there's plenty of sympathy on the part of students and many faculty, not all, for Palestine. But the level of pushback from Zionist organizations, that was very surprising to me. It was very, I mean, there was a level of rage directed at any of us who could say that there was something wrong with Israel's reaction. I mean, the sense was simply by the fact that Israel was attacked by Hamas meant that they had unlimited right of revenge in some way, okay? And this, I mean, people were motivated by something like that, even if they wouldn't articulate it that way. We had quite a bit of discussion in the newspaper, and there were people who, and what was interesting, not students, and not even just community members, but parents, which I found very disturbing and strange. And they wrote to us, a few of them wrote to all the people who signed this collective statement, and not initially in a rude way, but sort of saying, you're all wrong, you don't know what you're talking about. And if you can imagine that not being rude, but it could get a lot worse. And this was unpleasant in some ways, but we responded back and forth. And around that time, I was asked to make a presentation that Susie mentioned on what does this war mean in the U.S.? What does it say about the U.S., et cetera? It was maybe just a few days before the lecture. The title was announced more or less publicly. And it was exactly, as you said, Susie, the anti-Zionism is not the same thing as anti-Semitism, et cetera. And the reaction even, I mean, both from my colleagues, certain colleagues, somebody accused me of hate speech because apparently Zionist is an ethnic category or something. And I had no right to say that and blah, blah, blah. Other people were upset that I was critical of Israel. And it was a very, very different response than I'd ever gotten. Nobody ever paid attention to it before. They didn't care if I talked about it. And I should have known that this was the harbinger of even worse things to come, but I didn't know what to expect.
It's interesting because I think you're right. It's not just on your campus and elsewhere that it's been surprising in some ways to see that sort of level of intimidation. We see it, you know, in the hearings and getting university, you know, college presidents fired. But also on the other side, and I'll ask this later, it's also been amazing to see the breadth of this movement in solidarity that we've never seen before. Even the most liberal campuses. It used to be the case that you could have these kinds of discussions, but now you're seeing pushback. So one of the things that, you know, and I don't mean to interrupt your story. I want you to continue to tell it, but I wonder how you characterize so far this kind of pushback. You know, you said it to me privately that you wanted to talk about the weaponization of anti-Semitism, which is what this is. And I wondered if you saw it as successful. We did see in the UK, the successful use of that, and it destroyed Jeremy Corbyn's electoral campaign. And it seemed almost absurd on its face in Britain. But in the end, that was so successful. And now we see that same attempt to be used here. The Congress, led by the Republicans, passed a resolution essentially saying anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And so there's this broad-based effort to punish critical voices and silence dissent. So yeah, I guess my larger question is, by telling the rest of your story and what happened, what do you think? Is it successful or is it backfiring?
Well, I think the situation is extremely polarized to some extent along generational lines. There is actually what I think is a very small group of Zionist students completely adopted the position that this is all anti-Semitism. But I think for the most part, there wasn't much support for that on campus. And I think that among Jews, especially, the younger generation is completely opposed to Zionism in Israel. I mean, you see Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now, When? I mean, they are along with the Palestinian youth movement, among the most active parts of this movement. And they're pretty fearless. I mean, they go out and they do occupations and freeway blockage. I mean, everything. And I think that's very unusual compared to the past. And I think that it shows that there's a whole segment. And these are large groups. I mean, Jewish Voice for Peace, I think there's a periphery of like several hundred thousand people that participate in their activities. This is really unprecedented anytime, you know, since the establishment of the State of Israel. That's on the one side. There's a very hopeful signs of resistance, even on the part of Jews and others in these mass demonstrations to Israel's abuse of Palestinians. But I think on the other side, I mean, this is why it's the parents who are active, not the students, which I find absolutely astounding. I've never, ever seen that before. I mean, and before I gave my lecture, I got a number of letters from parents, which were fairly abusive, based only on the title of my lecture, that I would dare to impugn Zionism at all. I don't know if they knew that I was Jewish or not. I don't know. Each letter inevitably had something about, we pay your salary, you better do what we say, or something.
You're their client, in other words.
Something like that. Or I'm their employee.
Right.
I should. Yeah. And I never responded to any letters. I would do that.
But how did your administration react to that? Because I agree with
not
you. In all
very,
my years of teaching, I've never had to deal with parents on the one or two occasions. I have had it. The administration said, you know, your duty is to the student and not to the family of the student.
I mean, your administration was a bit more understanding than mine in this case. But I think that their feeling was, why are you doing things that are making the parents angry at us? It's not you who has to field the complaints, but we do. But I think it was probably a fairly small group who repeatedly called them. But I think that instead of saying to the parents, you know, there's free speech here, freedom of academic inquiry, et cetera, they made agreements to try to stop me from speaking and discourage me from speaking, et cetera. And I think in part with some of them, they caved into the pressure. And in other cases, they agreed with the parents. I'm not going to name names or positions. No. You know, they thought I was evil or something like that for bringing this up. So, I mean, there's a structural problem because they depend on these people for money, not just tuition, but donations. And, you know, as we've seen with Harvard, Columbia, et cetera, they threaten to pull millions of dollars if the administrations don't censor or silence the faculty. And there's a problem because they can't really legally do that. You know, in many cases, I became the visible face of the movement on campus because they can't do anything to me, but they could do something to other people. I was both surprised and disappointed with the attitude of the administration, which remains the same. I mean, it's like a constant battle to prevent them from trying to limit our academic freedom or discourage us from, talking about these controversial things, which, of course, is exactly what we're supposed to be doing with the students.
Exactly.
But I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's broader than that. And I'm glad you're bringing it up and also the response, because it's one thing to have emotionally charged debates on campus. That's de rigueur. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. And even on the nature of anti-Semitism, but it's another to use that charge to discredit and silence critics altogether, which is what we're seeing now. And you're saying that it didn't come necessarily from students, although there was students, but
yes,
from their parents and external forces. And then you just raised what I think is the key question before we go on to what it was you were going to say in that talk. I want to go over that too.
Yeah, sure.
But just, you know, the question about academic freedom, the right to teach without fear mm-hmm. from external influences that are seeking to shape what is said and what is taught. And you wrote in your blog piece on Verso Books blog that this is a new phase of persecution carried out with bipartisan support in higher education is the battleground of this assault on the freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. And of course, I mentioned earlier banning of books and banning of discussion on all sorts of things. And it's almost as if, I want to say, ignorance about what academic freedom is, what freedom of expression is, but it's deeper than that. And, you know, I think you used the word weaponized. So I'd like you to just talk a little bit. And of course, what we should do as, you know, faculty and teachers and librarians and everybody else to fight back.
Yeah, I mean, it's in some ways there are some difficulties with responding to this, but what's happened, and I could see this with the small group of students that were very upset about this, is the immediate recourse to the discourse of you've made me uncomfortable. But when they say
that's what we're supposed to do,
you're making me afraid. You know, I don't know what that means, because nobody's being assaulted, attacked, or I mean, I'm a leftist, and very few of my students ever have agreed with me politically, and I haven't punished them or humiliated them or anything of the kind. And same thing now. I think this discourse of you're making me uncomfortable, you're making me feel like I don't belong, I feel like someone's going to attack me or physically attack them, which I don't think is ever going to happen. If you have political differences with students, they may not like you. They may say, you know, I don't want to deal with you. I don't want to talk to you.
Or not take a class from you. They can, you know.
Well, I mean, but okay, if they feel that I, you know, am terrible, I can't be fair to them or something. Okay, I can't do anything about that. But I mean, if you take the position that Israel shouldn't have to have a ceasefire or something, yes, people are going to be unhappy with you, and they may be disturbed by your politics and the implication. And I mean, the other thing that we didn't even talk about is the fact that the Muslim and Palestinian students have received no such support, no such indulgence from the administration or the campus newspaper, which neglected them altogether. And we, the leader of the SJP, the Social Students for Justice in Palestine, of which I'm the advisor, is somebody who has 30 relatives in Gaza. And, you know, do you think she's having some anxiety? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Who needs support? Who needs, who has a real material reason to be desperately afraid? She does.
I'm hearing about other campuses where students are starting to use Title IX, threat against professors' academic freedom.
Yeah.
And so it just seems like the bar has gone up, you know, and this is what you rightfully call out in your blog as so disturbing, because this is part of a broad assault on dissent.
Yeah, that's when I was going to have a meeting with an administrator, and I quoted part of the letter, which says a lot. I was going to be a Title IX person from Human Resources. I'm not going to go into all the complications, but the implication was I had made students uncomfortable. I made them feel fearful in my lecture, although the students complaining did not attend my lecture. They relied on as far as I can see from the testimony of one student who's a first year, first semester student, and who was going in and out of the room during lecture and wasn't exactly. And so part of the accusation was ridiculous, et cetera. It's not a serious thing. It's not based on even listening to what I said. It's based on, you know, some idea that I'm opposed to Zionism, which I am. And I think that the school wanted to use that against me to silence me and make me an example to other people that, you know, you can't do this. And for various reasons, the faculty rebelled against this, and they actually passed a resolution that basically said you can't do any of this. So, okay. But I think the attempt was enough. And the attempt was based on, okay, we're not going to carry out some investigation of you for disciplinary purposes only because the complaint, which again I find bizarre, was not made by a student or employee of the college. Okay, but what if it was? If it was, then I could, according to the logic of the statement, be charged with some disciplinary infraction or something, which I have no idea what that would even be. And what was I charged with in terms of my lecture? But the meat of it was Israel is carrying out genocide and Israel is carrying out ethnic cleansing. And how could that possibly be an infraction of anything or merit disciplinary intervention when it's being debated all over the world, including by the International Court of Justice. It's absurd. And the idea that you can't discuss something that's being discussed in every media outlet and is a subject of court proceeding is just absurd. I mean, it's impossible to make sense of that in some way. And okay, it ended up that because of the faculty resolution and other things, it was dropped. The whole thing came to nothing. But the fact that it even happened, it's the effect is lasting. The effect is, and I think, you know, we've had people who just became inactive faculty because they fear for their jobs. They fear they won't get promoted. They fear that they'll be fired. It's had its effect. It has a silencing effect on people, and they have to think many times carefully about contesting anything to do with Israel. Even talking about Israel becomes something very difficult. One of the primary topics that I covered in my lecture was precisely the weaponization of anti-Semitism. I looked at the progression that led to the ultimate point that any criticism of Israel became de facto, and in many cases de jure, an anti-Semitic comment, okay? And that's important for a number of reasons. It's not just a moral question, because now there are different definitions of anti-Semitism, different documents that try to lay out all the possible forms that anti-Semitism can take, etc. And one of them is the International Holocaust Remembrance Group, the IHRA statement, which is the most expansive definition, problematic. But even that says, if you're talking about Israel in a way that you could talk about any other country, based on its conduct, that's not anti-Semitism. Okay, but the practice is far beyond that. The practice now is any statement you make against Israel, any criticism, and not just criticism, if you show images or like video footage of dead children, dead people, now the phrase is, it's blood libel, okay? And many people don't know what that means, but it's the accusation that originated in the medieval period in Europe that Jews are using the blood of Christian children to prepare the Passover matzah. And obviously that was a false accusation, but they're trying to say that any evidence presented against the state of Israel that they've killed children, for example, which is now about 14,000 children that they've killed, to bring that up is blood libel. Anything that points to murder, anything that points to, for example, now the preventing of food, and we see children dying of starvation, you're not supposed to talk about that. And until very still probably on the books, but until very recently in practice, Israelis couldn't talk about that. If you mentioned that, there was the case of a school teacher who was arrested and put into solitary confinement, and he's probably in his 60s, for saying something, you know, it's bad what's going on in Gaza. It's absurd. So,
can I just interject too? Because I usually talk to Yoav Peled about what's going on in Israel, and he said he just really can't do it now because his sister was fired. You know that the level of repression in Israel is increased, you know, so that it makes it dangerous for them to speak out. And that's actually where we have to see the opposition, if anything's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I think the success in other earlier periods of organizing against one of Israel's wars of aggression, it consisted of the fact that people in Israel, there was an anti-war movement in Israel that was very strong. Peace Now was at the beginning. And there were other parts of the left. But I think it's been missing for a long time. You know, I think the weaponization of anti-Semitism really took a huge leap forward around the war of 2014, because that was the first time that Israel openly experimented with allowing the public in a major way to see the atrocities that it was committing, the bombing of schools, of hospitals, UN refugee centers, huge apartment buildings, saying, you know, there's some Hamas person in there somewhere, we think. These are all crimes in various ways. But Israel was willing, not